Support for this segment provided by Freak Out and Carry On, a new podcast about politics through the lens of history. Hosted by journalist Ron Suskind and historian Heather Cox Richardson. Available wherever you get podcasts and on the WBUR Listen app. Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, GOP healthcare moves on life support. President Trump goes after Mueller and Sessions. John McCain has cancer. An Australian woman who called for help killed by American police. From a nearly full-on collapse of efforts on Monday, Mitch McConnell said he's still looking for a ray of light on Republican healthcare hopes.
It's pretty obvious we've had difficulty in getting 50 votes to proceed. But what I want to disabuse any of you of is the notion that we will not have that vote next week.
In an interview with the New York Times, President Trump went after Attorney General Jeff Sessions for recusing himself from the Russia investigation. Would have picked somebody else, the president said.
Sessions should have never recused himself. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job, and I would have picked somebody else.
And Australian Justine Damon shot dead by police in Minneapolis last weekend trying to report a sexual assault. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull demanded answers in an interview with Australian TV.
How can a woman out in the street in her pajamas seeking assistance from the police be shot like that?
Well, she was. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Eliana Johnson of Politico, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Eliana Johnson, national politics reporter for Politico. Eliana, thanks as always for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also in Washington, John McCormick, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. John, welcome back. Good to have you.
Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Eliana, and John.
The president not happy with his own attorney general this week. Here he was in that interview on Wednesday with the New York Times blasting Sessions for recusing himself from the Russia investigation.
How do you take a job and then recuse yourself? If he would have recused himself before the job, I would have said, thanks, Jeff, but I can't, you know, I'm not going to take you. It's extremely unfair, and that's a mild word to the president.
To use a mild word, and here Sessions saying he would continue on despite the criticism from President Trump.
I have the honor of serving as attorney general. It's something that goes beyond any thought I would have ever had for myself. We love this job, we love this department, and I plan to continue to do so as long as that is appropriate.
Eliana Johnson, I mean, everything swirling around this Russia investigation and the president going after the attorney general himself, and he says he won't resign, though it seemed like an invitation for a resignation. What do you see in this relationship now, and what does it matter in terms of where the investigation may go?
You know, buried in Politico's story on our homepage today is that when Jeff Sessions offered his resignation in late May, he did so at the demand of President Trump. He didn't offer it simply because he knew the president was angry at him. And by the next day, when he furnished a letter of resignation, Trump's mood had changed sufficiently that he declined that offer. So Jeff Sessions has never wanted to leave this job. I think that anecdote illustrates. And he's not going to do so. Behind that, I think, is Sessions's knowledge that if he were to step down, it would unleash a cascade of events that would really paralyze the federal government more broadly and the Russia investigation. I think he knows that it would really unleash a major crisis with Trump having to fill that spot. If either Sessions or the deputy attorney general stepped down, it would be a really bad thing. And I think Democrats and Republicans alike recognize that.
Describe that cascade of events that might come if it came to that.
I think it would be tremendously difficult for the president to appoint and confirm a replacement. He's having difficulty right now filling other senior administration job simply because of the infighting and paralysis in other parts of the administration and inside the White House. And because of the way he's treated the current attorney general, who was listening to the advice of not only his own counsel, but to career Department of Justice officials who said, that any attorney general in his position would have and should have recused himself. There's really no disagreement on that. But the president seems simply unable to accept that.
The president looking maybe to hip check, certainly to kind of body slam. We got all kinds of body going on here. But anyway, Jeff Sessions, at the same time this week, trying to draw a line around the work of Robert Mueller, who is looking into, of course, the whole Russia business. Again, from the interview with The Times, Maggie Haberman asked President Trump what he thought about Mueller looking into Trump family finances related to his investigation. Here was the president's response.
Would that be a breach of what his actual
I would say yes. Is? Yeah, I would say yes. By the way, I would say I mean, it's possible that it's a condo or something. So, I sell a lot of condo units mm-hmm. and somebody from Russia buys a condo. Who knows? I don't make money from Russia.
I don't make money from Russia. Well, Mueller is looking into it, so we'll see. New York Times reporter Michael Schmidt asked Trump whether he would fire Mueller if the special prosecutor dug into those business ties. Here's Trump's response.
But what would you do?
I can't answer that question because I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay, but Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, this was yesterday at a White House press briefing, said President Trump doesn't intend to fire Mueller at this time. But later in the briefing, she clarified the president's stance.
The president's been clear many times before that he has no financial dealings whatsoever with Russia. The point the president's making is that the investigation should stay within the confines of Russia meddling in the election and nothing beyond that. I'm not going to get into that.
No financial dealings whatsoever with Russia. I guess we shall see. John McCormick, what about this shot across the bow of Robert Mueller? Does it matter to Mueller?
I don't think so. I think that he's going to continue his investigation. But this is, there is some precedent for a campaign or White House going after a prosecutor. I mean, Bill Clinton's mm-hmm. aides accused Ken Starr of a witch hunt. Where this kind of gets into a weird and wild situation is this talk of actually firing Mueller. I mean, I don't see that happening. But if it did, it would cause a huge crisis. I just don't know if it's going to go that way or not.
Jack, I mean, firing Mueller, the president can't just do that out of hand. It has to go through channels. And even there, it appeared this week that his private legal team may be potentially laying a groundwork, though, for a firing, Jack.
Yes, and the president raised that in the interview with the New York Times, conflict of interest. They're looking at contributions to Democratic candidates made by some of the lawyers that Mr. Mueller has impaneled to help him. They're looking at Mueller's relationship with former FBI Director Comey. They're trying to find some sort of predicate here to go to the Assistant Attorney General, Mr. Rosenstein, who's in charge, and say, here we are. Here's evidence that he's violated, that Mueller has violated Justice Department regulations, conflict of interest, let him go. And then that case, does Rosenstein stay on, or do you have a replay of the Saturday night massacre? He resigns, and Trump appoints somebody else to do the dirty work.
I mean, Eliana, people are talking now about the U.S. potentially lining up here for a constitutional crisis. Is that too much? Is that too severe a characterization? And if we're drifting that way, what's the shape of it?
I don't think that we're there quite yet. I think it's, getting rid of Bob Mueller is something that's reverberating in the recess of the president's mind, as you saw in that New York Times interview. And I do think that, we've seen these probes expand before and that the place of greatest danger for the president is actually in his business dealings. But I actually don't know how what sort of a constitutional crisis this would unleash and what that would look like going forward. I do think it would be wholly unprecedented, but I'm just not steeped in the knowledge of exactly the way that that would unfold going forward if the president were to take action and fire Bob Mueller, if the attorney general or others were to step down as a result of that.
I mean, John, among other things, we hear this week that the president has his legal team looking into the extent of his pardon powers. Like how wide ranging are they? I mean, he obviously can pardon, I guess, anybody. But even the question of pardoning himself has come up. And the question of, well, what about his pardon powers for his family or others if he should be out of office at the time where things hit the fan? What does that say to you, John, that the president is investigating that front?
It says that he's worried. Obviously, he's worried about his son being caught up in this. I think that it's pretty clear that the president does have absolute ability to pardon anyone. It's not clear that he has ability to pardon himself, and that we're even discussing this just shows you how kind of crazy things are getting.
Nixon's legal team did discuss it and came to the conclusion that he could not pardon himself in the Watergate scandal.
And ultimately, I mean, this is a political question. You know, Bob Mueller is there to ultimately recommend recommendations for impeachment or not. This is a political question. It will fall to Congress. I mean, if we do get to the point where Mueller is filed, it will fall to Congress to investigate this themselves and decide whether it's an impeachable offense or not.
Jack Beatty, do you see the makings of a constitutional crisis sitting in front of us here?
Well, it would be a constitutional crisis if Mr. Mueller recommended impeachment or produced a bill of particulars against Trump, Mr. Trump, that was unequivocal in showing collusion with Russia, financial dealings with Russia, whatever the connection would be, and if Congress punted, if the Republicans refused to do anything. That would be more like a constitutional capitulation. And with the news this week of John McCain being stricken, that is such a he'd be such a central character in such a drama because he has the stature, the independence demonstrated over decades to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. We're going to follow our constitutional obligations here. If he is out of the Senate, he will be missed then.
Eliana, is the GOP ready to say no to President Trump, to leave him dangling if it comes to that?
I think it depends on what. It depends on what Bob Mueller surfaces. I think if it's something damning and they were given license, I think they would be ready to turn on him. And in many ways, I think they would welcome President Mike Pence.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to tell you to be sure and stay with us till the very end of this podcast for a preview of Freak Out and Carry On. It's WBUR's new podcast that addresses today's politics through a historical lens. Give it a listen, and thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, GOP health care on life support, their plans there. Donald Trump versus Jeff Sessions, Trump threatening Robert Mueller, maybe, his position. Trump team looking to pardons and the presidential pardon powers. John McCain fights cancer, the news this week. John McCormick is with us, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Eliana Johnson is here, national political reporter for Politico. Our own Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. What do you see in all these challenges and the Trump pushback this week? What about that Trump-Vladimir Putin after-dinner chat at the G20? What do you make of that? What's it mean that Rex Tillerson's Exxon showed reckless disregard, Treasury Department now saying, fining them a couple of million, reckless disregard for U.S. sanctions on Russia when Rex Tillerson was still CEO of Exxon? Now, of course, he is Secretary of State. And can Republicans bring their health care push back from the near dead? Just a little bit more On the Russia front here, that we all learned about Donald Trump's sit down with that, with the Russian gang or group last year. He was asked, the president was asked about that. He dismissed that meeting during the campaign last year with the Russian lawyer, Russian American lobbyist, Soviet-born financier, all present. Here's the president talking with the Michael Schmidt of the Times.
I just heard there was an email requesting a meeting or something. Yeah, requesting a meeting. That they have information on Hillary Clinton. And I said, I mean, that's standard political stuff.
Did you know at the time that they had the meeting?
No, I didn't know anything about the meeting.
So but you know, you get this.
It must have been a very important, meeting because I never even heard about it.
So this is about the meeting with Donald Trump Jr., of course, and it's the president saying here that he did hear there was an email requesting a meeting or something. They have information on Hillary Clinton. Thought that was pretty standard political stuff. But then I asked, did you know at the time they had the meeting? He said, no. So an email about it, and maybe it would, but did you know about the meeting? No. Well, that could stand some clarification, and maybe over time we'll get it. Lots of callers here. Carl in Nashville. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
You're welcome. You know, well, as far as racist Jeff Sessions go, I have no sympathy for him at all. In fact, I'm insulting as an American, even as a black American, that this man is our attorney general. So whatever treatment he gets from Donald Trump, good for him. As far as Robert Mueller goes, I think that he not only should he look into Donald Trump's finances, I think he should have a mandate to do so. There's so many reports, like the speech that Don Jr. had back in 08 when he readily admitted that they get in tons of money from Russia, to the deal down in Florida where they purchased a complex for $40 million and sold it to a Russian oligarch for $90 million. You know, there's a lot to look into as far as Donald Trump's finances, into his taxes. There's a lot of a lot of connection with Russia that's very unhealthy for our country.
There's been new reporting coming out. We're going to look at all that in this hour on Monday, Carl, and the Mueller investigation apparently looking at it as well. What's the bottom line you take out of it at this point, Carl?
Bottom line is this. He's in trouble. He's panicking. He's in trouble. His administration is paralyzed. And listen, I have no sympathy for Republicans. You know, they put this man in here, and I'm talking about the voters. They did this to our country. Bernie voters, they did this to our country. They put this plague upon us. And, you know, you reap what you sow.
Carl, we've got it from Nashville. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to my panel. Charlotte, North Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I believe what is happening to Trump is so unfair. I don't think that there's a politician in Washington that could stand up to the scrutiny that he is under, whether it be, you know, the finances, any of it. If you put anybody's life under a microscope like they're doing to Trump, I don't think anybody could survive it.
But let me ask you, David, I get your perspective there, but I want to get your bottom line, but let me just ask you this. You know, it's not just nitpicks they're coming up with here. I mean, what about Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russians? Were they offering dirt on a political opponent in this country? That's not just everyday sort of lint on your sweater.
Okay, yeah, and you had a DNC operative go over to the Ukraine and try to get dirt on Trump. The only problem with Trump is he's such a novice at politics that he doesn't put people in between himself or his direct aides and the stuff that they're getting on. Look at what McCain did with the dossier. He sent an aide over to Great Britain to get it so he didn't have his fingerprints on it. The problem with Trump is he just doesn't know how to play this game because he's never played it before. So, and one last thing, Tom.
Yeah, yes, sir.
There are 60 million of us that voted for Donald Trump. A lot of us voted for him for what's happening right now. He is for what the establishment on the Republican side and the Democrat side is doing. And if you don't think that if impeachment is recommended or is gone through with and that a good portion of us will not hit the street, you've got another thing coming.
David, we've got it. I appreciate your call. John McCormick, think through the politics of this president's problems right now. The Republican Party, those that voted for him, voters like David who are watching this, unpersuaded. How does that affect, first of all, the Republican majority on Capitol Hill and their very willingness to contemplate impeachment if Mueller should come up with material that points in that direction?
Well, in terms of the status of the Republican Party, the Republicans, their performance in the midterm elections will be highly correlated to the president's job approval rating, which is now below 40%. I don't see how you really keep the House representatives at that point. As to the caller's point about this spiraling out of control, I think that he's right that it could, and that's why Trump's upset. He's worried about looking into his tax information. But, that's what happens with these cases. Bill Clinton, the Whitewater investigation into a land deal ended up impeachment over a legal, if improper, sexual relationship with a young intern for lying about it and committing obstruction of justice. So the president, even if he didn't commit any crimes in this underlying issue regarding Russia, this could very well lead to something much bigger and much more that could still result in impeachment.
Eliana, though, our caller's talking about the spiraling out of control in the streets. He's looking at this and saying, well, there's nothing here that you wouldn't find if you looked at any other politician, if you look closely enough. And we Trump voters are not going to be happy. In fact, virulently the opposite. If our man is taken down, what do you hear in that, Eliana?
Look, I think that hits on an important point about the political dynamics in the country, which is that Trump was propelled to the presidency by a tremendous amount of anger. There was an idea before Trump that you had to be positive and optimistic and that was what voters wanted. And Trump really turned that on its head. He was, he was elected to office on a wave of sort of anger and negativity. And I don't think that that's actually been addressed. Instead, I think it has broadened and spread. And as David said, I believe I'm remembering the name of the caller correctly, the agenda has not advanced because of these ballooning scandals. And I'm not actually sure that if the president's approval rating is low, Republicans are going to do poorly in midterm elections. Republicans just won these four special elections in a row. And I do think that the anger in the country still exists. And, the political climate in the country is a mystery right now. But I do think it's a shame that because the president in many ways, okay, yes, he is nitpicked, but he also steps on, his own feet and is self-defeating in many ways. And he's not doing anything to address a lot of the anger and frustration in middle America and other places that got him elected.
Is it nitpicking to ask about potential collusion with a foreign government, long an enemy, Russia, in a U.S. presidential election? Is that nitpicking, Eliana?
That's not nitpicking. I would say there often is nitpicking of Trump, but there are many legitimate claims and legitimate inquiries, including Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with representatives of the Russian government. That being said, Democrats would criticize him for anything he does. I think that's the point of hashtag resistance. In many ways, that's their political platform right now. But even when the president is trying to be productive, he's self-defeating and steps on himself. I think the firing of James Comey illustrates that. And that's something that I think his supporters haven't totally grappled with, that he has a very difficult time being a productive actor on the national political stage.
Of course, I guess hashtag resistance could have been Mitch McConnell's hashtag for 8 years of Barack Obama.
Absolutely.
And Democrats say turnabout's fair play, but where does it get the country? Austin, Texas. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom, for having me. I was just having a question about this Don Jr. meeting with the Russian lawyer. Why would a Russian lawyer need to talk to Don Jr. about adoption, since that was a ban by Russia? So that's a Russian policy. So adoption is a code word for sanctions. So when Don Jr. meets with this Russian lawyer, she's providing him dirt on Hillary in return for lifting sanctions. So in that meeting itself is the quid pro quo. And then particularly if you look at the potential that information that she was providing was hacked information from the DNC, because just a few days later, Lucifer II was peddling that same information around to reporters, the financial records of the DNC. And so in that media itself, we see the quid pro quo. And so I don't see why people aren't interpreting that. But also, I'd also point out that if it was publicly available information, that the attorney could have just emailed it rather than flying from Moscow. And maybe she could, if she had a meeting, a meeting with one staff person, and that staff person writes up a memo and distributes it. So the people in the room knew that it was going to be highly sensitive information, which is code word for hacked information.
Well, so David, we've got it. And of course, it wasn't just a lawyer in the room. It was quite a posse, it turns out. Yes, the adoptions was in the email, but it was more than that that Donald Trump Jr. was informed of, dirt on Hillary, also as a kind of, hey, let's have this meeting come on to him. The word adoption's right there, though. And interestingly, Jack, it came up again this week, Donald Trump saying when he was at the G20 and had that side meeting at the dinner, the G20 dinner with just heads of state and spouses, it was reported that he sat down for an hour with Vladimir Putin at the sidelines there with nobody present except a Russian translator, interpreter. This was the president, again, in that Times interview, talking about that meeting with Putin on the sidelines at the dinner.
And while I was there, I said hello to Putin. Really pleasantries more than anything else. Was not a long conversation, but it was, you know, it could be 15 minutes, just talked about things.
Oh, okay, and maybe that's right. Within a few days then, we've got this U.S. move that ends, we're told. President Trump ending the covert CIA program to provide arms and supplies to Syrian rebel groups. Russians didn't like that going to them. Here's a former head of the Free Syrian Army. This is a long way from the dinner, but is this fallout? This is the head of the Syrian Free Syrian Army complained to the BBC NewsHour yesterday about what happened to American support in the wake.
Here we Syrians have the right to ask this very important question. Are there agreements and secrets and secret deals being implemented these days at the expense of the blood and sacrifices of the Syrian people?
Jack Beatty, the weird thing is that there were so few people in attendance to either of these Trump-Putin meetings. I mean, the other one is just Rex Tillerson. And, of course, Exxon now in trouble with our own Treasury Department, even under Trump, for breaking sanctions after the Russian seizure of the Ukraine, of Crimea from the Ukraine. Donald Trump says it was just a few minutes. We talked about adoptions. But we don't know, Jack.
We don't know. And foreign policy professionals, people who've been in Republican and Democratic administrations, say this was bad practice, malpractice on the part of the president to speak to the Russian leader without a translator present. An American translator.
Or anybody else.
Or anybody else, yes, to take down what was happening. And and then to have the announcement of this Syrian matter at the same time. John McCain criticized this. He said this is playing directly into Vladimir Putin's hand in Syria. That looks like a payoff of some kind. And, you know, the president said we talked about adoption. That's about the Magnitsky Act. That's about sanctions on Russia. And behind that is this is according to Julia Yaffe, the Russian-born American journalist reporting this week. She said, you know, what's all this about? It's about in Russia, if you have a pile of money, like an oligarch, you've got to get that money out of the country before somebody else steals it. And so there's a great pressure to get that money out of the country. The Congress's sanctions and the Magnitsky Act have essentially frozen that for many, many of these oligarchs who were named in this. And they desperately want that gone. And you could even have a picture where some of these people may have been doing business with Trump before that act, before those sanctions, and they want him, you know, we did business before, well, let's do business again. We just have to get rid of these sanctions. The whole thing is rife with disturbing questions.
But you hear our caller, Jack, who says, wait a minute, this is nitpicking. We're angry, and we elected this man to go and make some changes, and he's being tied down like, you know, Gulliver here by a thousand little complaints.
Yes, and that is the Steve Bannon strategy to hold on to voters like David. According to a poll this week, fully a third of Trump voters say that the meeting that Don Jr. admits happened didn't happen. In other words, they're so fully on board with Trump that they're denying something that even Trump admitted happened.
More than admitted. I mean, it's a fact. It's out, a fact. Everybody agrees.
It's a fact, but that shows the tenacious grip that Trump has through this on this sort of core support.
Eliana, you report that Steve Bannon's a little bit sidelined, taking himself a bit out of the game in the White House. Why? What?
Yeah, my report this morning suggests, and I heard from a lot of people in the White House, that it's really a phenomenon that's played out over the past 6 weeks where he's showing up in the White House every day. But in the beginning of the administration, you know, he was sort of an omnipresent in the Oval Office. He appeared in many pictures over the president's shoulder, and he just hasn't been showing up in major policy meetings. There's a policy process playing out on trade right now. He hasn't been showing up at those for about the past 6 weeks. He didn't go on the president's past two foreign trips. He wasn't in Warsaw. He played no role in crafting the president's big speech, for which he was widely credited, that he delivered in Warsaw. It had major nationalist themes. He wasn't in Paris with the president. And, you know, he's really removed himself from the policy process. People are speculating that he's anticipating a big staff shakeup in August. We've heard lots of talk about that, of course, but that he's really trying to keep his head down.
I'm Tom Esbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, O.J. Simpson was granted an early parole yesterday after serving 9 years of an armed heist at a Las Vegas hotel. O.J. will be out in October. Here's his plea to the parole board.
I've done my time. You know, I've done it as well and as respectfully as I think anybody can. I think if you talk to the wardens, them, they'll tell you I've been. I gave them my word. I believe in the jury system. I've honored their verdict. I've not complained for 9 years.
October, O.J. to be out. 10-year-old Jude Sparks discovered fossil remains of an American mastodon while playing with his new walkie-talkie on a hike in New Mexico this week. He told CNN about his pretty amazing moment of discovery.
When I was running up the canal, I tripped on the tusk and my face landed next to the bottom mandible, which is the bottom jaw. And farther up, I saw the tusk. Another tusk.
It's a child's dream. And Despacito, the Spanish language summer hit by Puerto Rican stars Luis Fonso and Daddy Yankee plus Justin Bieber, is now the most streamed song in history with 4.6 billion plays in 6 months. The first Spanish song to hit number one on the Billboard since the Macarena.
Despacito. Quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído. Para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo.
Okay, we're moving. We're looking at a week in the news. GOP healthcare on life support, Trump, and all the troubles around the Russian front this week. John McCain and cancer. You can join us. What do you see on the healthcare front? Can Republicans bring it back? Should they, their push? What are you thinking about John McCain? Can you blame Australians for being outraged over the police shooting of that Australian woman in Minneapolis? Do you think you may run into OJ on the street later this year? He's paroled. John McCormick is with us, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Eliana Johnson of Politico and our own Jack Beatty. Healthcare, wow, big collapse early in the week. Republicans meeting, talking, trying, seeing they can find something. Opposition has been stiff all the way along. Even yesterday, dozens of demonstrators outside the office of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell protesting the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. President Trump with a few different lines on this week. On Tuesday, after the Senate health care, collapse, debacle, the president said he was not going to own the effort to fix Obamacare. Let it fail, he said.
Let Obamacare fail. It'll be a lot easier. And I think we're probably in that position where we'll just let Obamacare fail. We're not going to own it. I'm not going to own it. I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. We'll let Obamacare fail, and then the Democrats are going to come to us.
Just walk away. Let it fail. But the next day, at a White House Republican luncheon, the president, with a different line, said GOP senators should skip their August recess to get a health care bill passed, a change of tune from the day before when he said, just let it fail. Here's Trump the next day.
We can repeal, but we should repeal and replace, and we shouldn't leave town until this is complete, until this bill is on my desk. And until we all go over to the Oval Office, I'll sign it and we can celebrate for the American people.
Eliana Johnson, what are the real options for Republicans at this point in the Senate?
Frankly, I think health care is dead, despite there being a lot of movement around it. But I don't think anything's happening going forward. And I think the tragedy or the frustration for many Republicans, as well as for the White House, is that it makes advancing and pushing the ball forward on the rest of their policy agenda all that much harder. There's a lot of talk about tax reform and infrastructure reform right now. But the fact is that failure on health care makes tax reform much harder. What goes unmentioned in a lot of these discussions about tax reform is that the Republicans need to pass a budget and they need to address the debt ceiling before they move on to tax reform. And there's an enormous fight about the budget itself that's mired in the House right now.
Do you think, John, that they can pull it out somehow? Is there still a chance? Mitch McConnell said, look, we're going to have a vote on the motion to proceed here, which would open it up. Is there an opening?
You know, next week, I think there's basically zero chance. I mean, for there to be even a tiny chance, you know, you'd have to bring John McCain back, who the tragic news this week of him being diagnosed with brain cancer. He's being treated in Arizona. As long as John McCain is gone, there's basically zero chance that people get together. You know, there are 52 Republicans in the Senate. Susan Collins and Rand Paul say they're basically against any version of this repeal and replace effort. And so that means you're going to have to get everybody back on board, including John McCain, who is being treated right now in Arizona. You're going to have to get Mike Lee, who has a specific policy dispute. Jerry Moran of Kansas, kind of surprising. He's not even up again for re-election until 2022 from a very conservative state. He just thinks it's a bad process, bad policy. You've got a handful more moderates who think that the Medicaid reform goes too far. So, you know, could you maybe a few weeks or a month down the road come up with something? I think there's a possibility they do something, but I do think right now the most likely thing that will happen is that Trump is right. The president was right that they'll probably end up trying to, quote unquote, let the law fail. I think he's wrong that they're not going to own it. I think the voters will hold the president and Congress accountable for failing to fulfill their campaign promises. You know, the failure that they couldn't reach consensus. They had 7 years in Congress to sort of hash out their differences, figure things out. And so there are, of course, it's a difficult haul. You know, it took 60 Democratic senators to pass the law in the first place, a committed president. You've got 52 Republicans in the Senate and an uncommitted president who doesn't know anything about healthcare policy. So it doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere.
It's a tall order right now and a lot on the line. Ted Cruz last night on Fox News with Sean Hannity saying, look, if we blow this, we may blow the whole agenda.
If we screw up Obamacare repeal, tax reform becomes much harder. If we get this right, if we follow through on Obamacare repeal, it sets this up for this to be the most productive Congress in decades. Whereas if we're paralyzed, we could blow an historic opportunity.
And, of course, Republicans watching. Philip in Lynchburg, Virginia. Philip, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about health care real quick. I consider myself remotely conservative. And the past 8 years, Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, was kind of a disaster for me and my family. For multiple reasons I won't go into. But finally, you know, conservatives, we get the House, we get the Senate, and we get the White House, and they've been chanting these past 8 years that, you know, we want to repeal, we want to replace and make it better, and we can't even agree in between traditional conservatives and moderate conservatives. So it's really frustrating for me, and I like to think that I speak for most conservatives when I say that. But I think that we should just resolve to repeal just straight up, because repeal is something that I think all conservatives can agree on. And I look at it like healthcare is a luxury. It's not a right. I know a lot of people probably disagree with me on that.
I mean, so no replacement, you're saying. Just knock it out and then good luck, everybody.
Well, yeah, that sounds really harsh and cold when you say it like that. But, you know, Ted Cruz was right when he said that, you know, if we don't do something about health care, at least repeal it, then the rest of the agenda is going to be very hard to complete. And I honestly might even consider voting Democrat if my conservative, you know, congressmen disappoint me like this. It's rather disheartening, in other words.
Philip, we've got it. And I'm sure Republicans, politicians listening very closely to that repeal. And then we'll see. Caller from Lynchburg. Let's get one more and we'll talk about it. Albany, New York. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I was one of 200 people that got arrested at the Capitol on Wednesday protesting the repeal bill. There are people with HIV/AIDS, people with disabilities, people with health care needs that travel from all over the country to talk about how they'd suffer and some would die if they lost their care. The repeal bill and the other proposals the Republicans have had out there are terribly destructive. They would really hurt people. And they don't do any of the things that Trump promised when he's run for president. They don't reduce premiums. They don't reduce copays. Everybody will not have coverage. And there are some things that would do that. We could restore the investments that will keep the market strong. We could expand Medicaid or Medicare. We could keep the protections and do things that would really help people. And instead of just, like, hurting a lot of folks to go on with their agenda, the Republicans really should look out for the country, their constituents, and everybody, instead of just trying to score political points.
Eliana Johnson, if it's, I mean, something, well, maybe nothing happens. And the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, putters along here. But even Democrats say we need some fixes on it. What are the odds of a straight-up repeal by your lights, Eliana? What are the odds of it going the other way? The Republicans saying, well, we've got to work with Democrats or this is going to be a disaster.
I think the odds of a straight-up repeal are approaching zero. The difficulty with repeal and replace was Republicans' resistance to getting too close to repeal. And the irony is that, you know, the vast majority of these Republicans voted to repeal this bill several times. I think Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, when she was a member of the House, voted to repeal the bill like 40 times.
So why don't they don't actually want to repeal it? Why not?
I think that's exactly right. It really shows the emptiness of their the political rhetoric and the lack of seriousness that many of these Republicans have approached healthcare policy with, because they now realize, and Capito is a good example, and I am picking on her right now, but she realizes that many of her constituents in West Virginia, which is a state where many citizens are on Medicaid mm-hmm. and Medicare, would be adversely affected by this. But look, healthcare policy writ large is an area in which people don't like change and disruption. Obamacare was tremendously unpopular, and Democrats suffered for it at the polls. And I think that's not something that Republicans want to do. I've noted many times that Obama and Democrats were willing to pay a political price to do something they believed in, and that's not something that Republicans appear willing to do right now. These things are not supposed to be cost-free politically.
Danielle in Tampa, Florida. Danielle, you're on the air.
Hi. My point is that the Republicans had 8 years to come up with a plan. If they hated the Obamacare system so bad, they had 8 years to come up with an alternative plan and then have a plan A and a plan B. The moment Trump won, and then the Republicans took over the House and the Senate, they should have quickly said, here's what we're going to do. Here it is. We've worked on it for 8 years and be done. They did not do this. This shows a lack of planning, a lack of care, and a lack of concern. You don't wait 8 years and think, oh, okay, now we got to do something. And the whole notion of, well, we didn't think Trump was going to make it is not a good excuse. Are there some things about Obamacare that need to be improved? Yes, improve those, leave what works alone, and move it forward. And if you can't figure it out after the 8-plus years that you've had, maybe you don't need to be in those seats.
Danielle, I appreciate your call. John, do you see the potential for some kind of, or maybe they'll just be forced into it by circumstance, working with the Democrats?
I think there is a decent chance that there could end up being some sort of bipartisan bailout, you know, for the insurance industry, because there are, you know, an increasing number of counties where there are no insurers who are offering plans in the Obamacare exchanges. They've abandoned the field. In a third of the country, I believe, there's only one insurer. So you basically got monopoly prices. You know, I think the caller's right. They should have figured out what's wrong, and it's actually taken them a long time, Republicans, to figure out that the problem with Obamacare, and I think that actually the conservatives, people like Ted Cruz, who a couple of years ago would have been unreasonable are now actually trying to get to a reasonable solution where they correctly identify the problem with this is that we've decided we're going to offer health to people with pre-existing conditions. The problem is you basically done that by imposing a hidden tax on healthy people who just don't happen to have employer insurance. So, you know, someone who's middle class might be paying 2, 3, 4 times more for their health insurance premiums in rural parts of this country. And they don't have the money for that. You know, that's not going out money. That is mortgage payment money. That is car payment money. And so what they're saying now is the conservatives of all people are saying, listen, let's just pay directly with tax subsidies to help people who have pre-existing conditions. Don't impose this hidden tax on the individual market. You know, but that is the, there are some moderates who don't exactly see it that same way. They want to keep the Obamacare regulation just as it is with pre-existing conditions. So, you know, you had 7 years, the caller's right, where Republicans didn't quite get down to what exactly repealing Obamacare meant. There are, of course, all sorts of procedural difficulties to actually doing a full repeal, but there's also just a lack of consensus in the party on what to do.
Jack, we
have
a call.
The other thing I would add,
quickly to
John's point, is that when repealing Obamacare after year one or two after it was passed was a far easier task accomplished than at year 7, and that's another thing I don't think Republicans quite grappled with.
Mm. Jack, we had the caller from Albany who was there protesting, arrested for protesting at the Capitol this week. We've heard voices calling in saying, we want this repeal. But there were a lot of voices right there in the halls of Congress saying, wait a minute, what about the health care we need?
Yes, and these people deserve great credit. They're citizens, citizen activists, and many of them are differently abled. CNN did a portrait of a bus coming up from Louisiana with mothers and their differently abled children. One child in particular, an infant, perhaps a toddler, on one machine keeps it alive, the other machine feeds her. This woman was taking that child to the Republican National Committee to picket outside to show this is what was going to happen. This could happen. These machines could be undone, unplugged, if you go ahead with cutting $1 trillion out of Medicaid. And in the end, that woman couldn't do it because the child developed an infection. You know, it's not for nothing that since November, according to the Washington Post ABC poll, Donald Trump's approval rating among white women without college degree, which pretty much describes the women on this bus, I think, is 19 points lower than it was in November. These women understand what Medicaid means to their children. They understand what it means to their parents in nursing homes. They're the ones in the families too often in America who deal with these realities. And if this bill does not pass, much credit must go to these Americans.
Eliana Johnson, what's the talk on Capitol Hill? Does John McCain come back?
I don't think anybody knows right now, but, you know, my thought about John McCain in general, and I think there's been, you know, wide talk that this is a very aggressive form of cancer, but that McCain is obviously a fighter. But to me, he's just sort of a dying breed of lawmaker who's considered a giant on both sides of the aisle and commands bipartisan respect that we simply don't see as much of in sort of the new people coming into politics these days.
Bipartisan respect. That is an idea. Well, somebody needs to hang on to it. John McCain has kind of represented it for a long time, and our thoughts very much with him this week. The decency of the man, especially when he was running for president. Of course, as Donald Trump says, he didn't win. Eliana Johnson, thank you very much for being with us from Politico today.
Thanks, Tom.
John McCormick with the Weekly Standard. Great to have you, John. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, a new politics and history podcast from WBUR.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this preview from our show. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Freak Out and Carry On wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a listen to this excerpt. We chatted about Trump's approval ratings and historical parallels. And I guess my question is, when was the last time you had a president arrive into office and summon this sort of open, vigorous public protest?
Well, it was the presidency that everybody comes to first whenever they think about American history, and that was the presidency of Benjamin Harrison.
Oh, of course. I mean, the stage play, I love that, and the musical they did. It's fabulous, yeah.
Everyone always forgets about Benjamin Harrison, and there's a reason for that. He gets written out of history, but it was a very similar situation. A person who came to office after a Democratic president, Cleveland, who was popular among people who wanted reform, wanted to make sure the government did not work just for the very wealthy. Harrison said that he would make some reforms, including to the tariff, did not win the popular vote, lost the popular vote by 100,000 votes. Gets put in with the Electoral College. As soon as he gets in, it's very clear that there's been hanky-panky going on. People are infuriated by that. They start to protest, and Harrison and his men keep saying, no, 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 we've got this. We know how to make America work again, how to bring the economy back, although it wasn't actually that bad right then. He puts his son into an important position and simply refuses to note that there is these protests going on, that people are literally starving out in the West. And he completely misses what's happening out West, which is, again, this huge protest that becomes the Alliance Movement of 1890, which takes over the House of Representatives by a margin of 2-1 that year and virtually flips the Senate. And Harrison is completely blindsided by it.
Right, and drives politics forward from that point. I mean, in a way, the reaction to Harrison becomes the defining thing of that
period.
That's
exactly right, and that's where we get the populist movement. And again, the progressive movement grows out of that at the turn of the next century.